As I explained in the last presentation, the dialectic process, which is simply dialogue, it's putting dialogue into practice. And I keep pointing out the difference between discussion and dialogue within our means of communication. Discussion has an external authority. Dialogue is subjective. In other words, discussion is objective and dialogue is subjective. What the liberal will do is they will produce a subject to talk about that they would call having a discussion, but it's a result of first going through dialogue. In other words, everything becomes material. This is dialectical materialism or historical materialism. One is rigid, the other is in flux. Both of them tie you through dialogue to the world. Discussion can be of the world, but there's an external authority, whether it's a law of nature or whether it's above nature, it would be God or the parent. Now, the parent is an example of God in that the father gives a child a command that's not from that child's sense experience. The father might tell the child to do something the child's never experienced before in his life. He may not want to do it. He may want to be doing something else. But that's that external element in that child's life. And so looking at the dialectic, the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, pointing out again, if you start with the father, the commands and rules and facts and truth, this is old traditional education, and you hold the child accountable to doing right and not wrong according to those standards, then the child has to humble and deny himself. He has to not yield to the temptations of the lust. And we've all experienced this. For instance, the dopamine that is tied to our nature, which ties us to the world. You have recess, say as a child in school, the bell rings and now you can go out and play and you're all excited, and then you come in to the next class and you just get dull, you know. You might get tired and you lose attention. The lust for pleasure is really the lust for the dopamine. It's nothing wrong with dopamine. God gave it to us that we'd enjoy the creation. The problem comes is when we're told to do something and we make the pleasure the agenda of life. That's what Marx said. To enjoy the present is to identify with the actual. And the reason he said that is that he wanted to be a sinner in a sinful world, as he said, not being happy in a sinner in a sinful world. In other words, rejecting God, everybody's a sinner. You know, everybody's the same. Everybody has lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the pride of life. If all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and you get rid of God, then what gives the person who owns a business the right to fire somebody because they're sinning, because they're doing things wrong? We're all in the same boat. And so that's the mindset of this process, of those who practice it. And so Marx is all about getting rid of objective truth. It's the objective truth that causes alienation. So if the father's the thesis, then the child's carnal nature is the antithesis, and the child has to humble himself. He's now accountable to the father. He has a guilty conscience when he does things wrong. The guilty conscience sustains the father's authority in society. And so the child cannot find identity with the group, because if you have 20 students from different homes, they have different standards. If they're obedient to their parents, they're not going to get along. So that is a result of preaching and teaching and discussion. If I can put that child in an environment where there's no dialogue and there's no judgment, there's no condemnation, there's no casting out. Remember, the father is he authors and then he enforces. So we remove the enforcement part and we go to dialogue. I feel and I think. Now the child is the thesis. His feelings is the drive of life, the drive of communication. And the father then, in other words, the child's positive, and anyone who comes in the room with a father structure, right, wrong, black, white, sheep, goats, heaven, hell, you know, humble, deny, die to yourself in order to do right, not wrong, according to established commands, rules, facts, and truth, that's a father's structure, that person is negative. They're now the antithesis. It's one or the other. And we can confuse the two. You know, we can do a mind trip. It's called confusion, is we're trying to fuse discussion and dialogue. And so the only way you can get to synthesis is that you let the 20 students find what they have in common, and what they have in common is lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life, all that's of the world. And that's behavior science, because science is only that which is of the world. So that is, I know I covered that an awful lot in the last couple presentations, dragged it out, but that's what traditional education simply started with, the father's authority. You learn facts, you know, and then you got bad grade if you didn't get them. And so the agenda was to learn these facts and to do what's right. Now, I said I wanted to cover, Warren Bennis, his work, book, The Temporary Society. His name comes up a lot in the research of contemporary education back in the 50s and 60s. In fact, that section I read about brainwashing, he was involved in that project. He writes in Temporary Society. And how I came across these names is I was reading Bloom's taxonomies. In the end, he had a bibliography, and during his writing, he mentioned authors, and so I went and checked those books out in the library and just did the book chase. Like I said, I ended up reading over 600 social psychology books in a matter of 5 years. Some of them reading three times over. I mean, 900-page books. Some are so boring that, you know, you're just telling yourself to get a life. But I wanted to understand what this process was. And over that time period, I collected like 2,400 slides or quotations. And they're quotations like this. This is Warren Bennis. And, you know, I asked a guy who was involved in this process. I was sharing some new notes. And he says, well, after a while, you figure it all out. You don't have to read anything more. It's all the same. It's just more of the same. So Warren Bennis, in Temporary Society, he writes, and this is important, listen to this, any intervention between parent and child tend to produce a familiar democracy regardless of its intent. In other words, anybody who comes between the parent and child liberates the child. Even though you're trying to restore, see, focus on the family was all about dialogue. It was about building relationship. You have to focus on the father. If you focus on the family, it literally liberates the children from the father's authority. Somebody else has come in. The consequence of family democratization take a long time to make themselves felt, but it would be difficult to reverse the process once begun. Once the parent can in any way imagine his own orientation to be a possible liability to the child in the world approaching. Once uncertainty is created in the parent, how best to prepare the child for the future, the authoritarian family is moribund. In other words, it's dead. Regardless of whatever countermeasure may be taken, the state, by its very interference in the life of its citizens, must necessarily undermine a parental authority which it attempts to restore. For however much the state or community may wish to inculcate obedience and submission in the child, its intervention betrays a lack of confidence in the only objects from whom a small child can learn authoritarian submission. See, no one has come between you and God. You open up the Word of God, you humble yourself before Him, you ask for wisdom, His Holy Spirit will give you understanding of the Word. I'm not saying you don't listen to somebody else's teaching, but you weigh it. You don't let it come between you and the Word. Everybody's running to the Christian bookstore. You get in a Bible study, you got to pull some author's book out. Now, I've used author's books, but what I would do is I'd take the scriptures out. And yeah, I'd read their stuff, but I would take the scriptures out, and we just cover the scriptures and let the Lord lead. In understanding, leaning not to our own understanding. So having covered discussion and dialogue, this whole process, again, is based upon dialogue. I want to find here Hegel. Because George Hegel definitely is famous for the use of, that's what I was going to do. I was going to cover a revolution. Yeah, that's why I was here. I didn't register at first. I'm sorry, I'm stumbling around here. In an ordinary discussion, people usually hold relatively fixed positions and argue in favor of their view as they try to convince others to change. It's persuasion. Okay, with a discussion, you're trying to persuade, and it's an issue of right and wrong. In dialogue, a dialogue is essentially a conversation between equals. The spirit of dialogue is in short, the ability to hold many points of view in suspension. And so you come in with your position, somebody else comes with theirs, and let's put aside our differences, let's put aside the fathers, let's all just find, and it along with a primary interest in creating a common meaning. What's the meaning? That's identity of relationship. It's common self-interest. In Jürgen Habermas, then, he writes in his Knowledge of Human and Human Interests, in the dialogic relation of recognizing oneself and the other, they experience the common ground of their existence. This is the purpose of the group grade. Be positive, not negative. We're going to be open-ended, non-directive. We're going to dialogue our opinions to a consensus. All of that negates a father's authority. No, nobody can come in and say, cannot, must not, thou shalt not, and be accepted. It has to be in flux. It has to be in changingness, as Rogers put it. Now, where does this go? Lukács, who famous key, along with the Italian Marxist, I can't even think of his name right now. Lukács writes, only when the immediate interests, in other words, the group's interests, we find the group, what they all have in common is interest, are integrated into a total view and related to the final goal of the process, do they become revolutionary. Now, I'm describing revolution. Revolution is simply the getting rid of the father's authority and the guilty conscience it produces. The whole system of Marxism, he writes, stands and falls with the principle that revolution is the product of a point of view in which the category of totality is dominant. In other words, once that group finds common identity, and that common identity is they're working on a project they want to fulfill, and anybody who comes in the room that's negative, they learn to convert. If they can't, they will silence them. And if they can't, they will censor them. And if they can't, they will remove them. And that is practicing or doing the praxis of negating the father's authority in that group. The agenda of the group grade is to train everybody how to get rid of the patriarchal paradigm. No other purpose. See, the Soviet system is a diverse group of people. Now that's deviancy, has to be incorporated. Dialoguing their opinions to a consensus. Over social issues, in a facilitated meeting, because it doesn't happen naturally, to a predetermined outcome. Well, what's a predetermined outcome? That no decision be made without a diverse group of people dialoguing to consensus over social issues in a facilitated meeting. And what that guarantees is there is no father's authority that produces the outcome. So everything's in flux. Everything's subject to change. Everything's subjective. That's the revolution. The revolution is to negate anything that's rigid in the environment that doesn't produce pleasure, and it produces pain. Jürgen Habermas writes then, revolutionary violence, because that's what it's all about. It's violence in the classroom. It may not be physical, but it's very violent for the child who's being martyred. He is being rejected by the group. He's going through a lot of pain, horrendous pain. You know, the rejection of others is really one of the most painful experiences in life. And every child who goes in with absolutes has to be martyred. Has to be. If he's going to participate in the group, he has to suspend the Lord on the cross. I'm just being blunt here. You have to, as a Christian, you have to put Christ aside and make yourself God. And make the group God. And make the facilitator of change your Savior. Saving you from God, from the Father. And that is a revolution. You've gone from a patriarch through a matriarch, which is feelings, to a heresiarch, which is change. So, revolutionary violence reconciles the disunited parties by abolishing the alienation of class antagonism. In other words, the fathers alienated the children because we have 20 fathers with children. I have them all in my class and they're disagreeing with one another. And so now there's alienation, and it's because there's this father above and the children below system. And so the violence then, once these children go home, I don't have to tell them to go home and challenge their parents' authority. But once they go home, that you first find identity with themselves, common ground, then they'll go home, challenge their parents' authority, and I have then produced a revolution. And I've gotten rid of the father's authority system in their lives. So this alienation of class antagonism that set in with the repression of initial morality. What is the morality? Lust of flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. Eros. The revolution that must occur is the reaction of suppressed life. There it is. The child's dissatisfied. It's like in the wilderness, when they were in the wilderness heading to the promised land, heading out of Egypt. They were murmurers there. They wanted to go back. Okay, they were suppressed. They were oppressed. They didn't feel free at all. And so if I can get your child in a around others that are dialoguing, I feel and I think, they're going to be resenting parental authority, which will visit the causality of fate upon the rulers. In other words, because now they're encouraged in their reaction against the suppressor, the parent, They've now feel free to question a parent, to challenge them, to attack. It is those who establish such domination and defend positions of power, he's talking about the parent, of this sort, who set in motion the causality of fate. Now, this is stimulus response. See, this is not from God, because God tells you, God has given us the ability to read books and to write books, to tell and be told. Only creature created that has that ability. And so what we're doing now is stimulus response. If somebody comes in the room and stimulates pleasure, they're approved. If they stimulate pain and the rejection or removal of pleasure, then there's hostility towards it. There's the effort to remove it or to change it. And so because the parent refuses to abdicate, then there is this violence against it. You've got to remove it from the environment. And so in this logic, the parents actually produce their own death. And so they set in motion the causality of fate, divide society into social classes, suppress justified interests, lust of flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life, call forth the reaction of suppressed life. In other words, now the children are justified in attacking the parent, and finally experienced the just fate in revolution. Now, this from a man who helped set up the language for the World Court. This is Bloom's taxonomy. Sounds innocent. Well, you know why the teachers love it? Because that's their children. That's their children. Not the parents' children. It's their children. And then Lukács says the Communist Manifesto makes the point that the bourgeoisie produces its own grave diggers. And we cover that. The bourgeoisie literally are the children under the father's authority. If you look at the structure, we've covered the group. I'm just trying to cover some of this material that we've had in the past. We've covered curriculum. Sigmund Freud. Let me cover him. The first chapter, first and second verses. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of God, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. Now, Herbert Marcuse, in Eros and Civilization, a psychological inquiry into Freud, and he was a liberal out in the West Coast, caused revolution wherever he went and spoke. He writes, it is not really a decisive matter whether one's killed one's father or abstained from the deed. Now, he's paraphrasing Sigmund Freud. If the function of the conflict and its consequences are the same. In other words, dad can stick around as long as he no longer functions as a father in the home. And then Marcuse continues, the hatred, and he's actually, parts of this is Sigmund Freud. This is the definition of Sigmund Freud. The hatred against patriarchal suppression, a barrier to incest. Where are we as a culture? This, the outcome of psychology, the very core of psychology. It's on a train with no brakes. You're going down the path and you can't say, it's all subjective. And it's all subjective to the flesh. And its outcome is incest in any form. A barrier to incest. Who's that? That's the parent. A desire for the sons to return to the mother, that's the Oedipus complex, in the rebellion of the exiled sons, the collective killing. See, there, the father casts the sons out. Remember, the prodigal son leaves. And then he comes to his senses. He humbles himself. He comes back to his dad to repent. He repents, humbles himself, and he finds out that his dad's money wasn't the agenda. It was his love. He discovered the greatest thing in his life was his father's love for him, not the money. But not here, not Sigmund Freud. These kids come back and they kill the father. They collectively kill. If you're in a diverse group dialoguing to a consensus meeting, open-ended, non-directive, be positive, not negative, you're killing the father. You're not only killing him. He says the collective killing and devouring of the father. He's negated. You eat him, there's nothing left. There's nothing around. There's no need for a tombstone. There's no history left. You know, they want to get rid of history. That's all it's about. You don't want to look back and see any heritage of a father's structure and culture. Everything's the here and now. Everything's in the moment. Then Norman O'Brown, he writes, Freud commented that only through the solidarity of all the participants could the sense of guilt be assuaged. You know, when you get with a group and they're doing wrong, all of a sudden that guilty conscience is gone because they're all doing what they want, you know, what you want to do, and you're going with a herd. Self-perfection of the human individual is fulfilled in union with the world in pleasure. According to Freud, the ultimate essence of our being is erotic. Eros is fundamentally a desire for union with objects in the world. Eros is the foundation of morality. And then Brown states, to experience Freud is to partake a second time of the forbidden fruit. You ever notice the Apple computer, the apple's got a bite out of it? Think that through. To experience Freud is to partake a second time of the forbidden fruit. You cannot take psychology or practice psychology without going back to the garden and eating that fruit. The second, and this is Marcuse, the original sin must be committed again. And we must again eat from the tree of knowledge in order to fall back into the state of innocence. You got to get rid of the father. Now, now we'll get back to Hegel, because he lays out the importance of the, let's see if I can get here real quick. Hegel writes, the child, contrary to appearance, is the absolute, the rationality of the relationship. So he doesn't have the father's restraint. It's just the pure child. He is what is enduring and everlasting, the totality which produces itself once again as such. That's why you start with the child. You start with the child's feelings, because that's where reality is in a socialist mindset. And then I add, because once he is liberated from the father's authority, and now I'm sharing this, once he is liberated from the father's authority to become as he was before the father's first command, rule, fact, or truth came into his life, separating him from himself and the world, where he was of and for himself and the world only. So it's the father in that child's life that's corrupted him. And so you have to start with the culture is child-based. We have a child-based culture. Look at the adults. 40-year-olds playing with toys. And then he continues. Now, if we make the child the lust of flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life, that, the foundation of our life, we're all the same. Husband, wife, children, we're all the same. And so he can make this statement. This is Karl Marx before Karl Marx. This sounds more like Karl Marx than Karl Marx. On account of the absolute and natural oneness of the husband, wife, and child. What is there? What's the oneness? Their common lust for pleasure, including their lust for the approval from one another, and their resentment towards restraint. They're all the same. So you've negated the traditional home. Where there is no antithesis, see, no top-down right, wrong way of thinking and acting. I'm adding that. Where there is no antithesis of person to person or subject to object, the surplus is not the property of one of them, since their indifference is not a formal or legal one. You have no inalienable rights. You have no right of private property, private business, private conviction. See, Rousseau said, the fruits of the earth belong to us all and the earth itself to nobody. So Rousseau and these guys can work you till you're dead and take your fruit and say thank you, because we're all the same. Well, God said the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. This is in complete rejection of what God has created. Moreno, who wrote Who Shall Survive, J.L. Moreno's, he came from Europe and he created a new God. He got rid of, he said, Jesus must wither away. In his book, Who Shall Survive, he says, thinking through the process, it is dialectically faulty to start with a negative, with anxiety. In other words, the parent. Don't let that traditional teacher control the classroom. The problem is to name the dynamic factor provoking anxiety to emerge. Where's that from? Anxiety is a function of spontaneity. In other words, if I get the group into dialogue and a parent comes in, now there's anxiety. Spontaneity can be defined as the adequate response to a new situation or the novel response to an old situation. With decrease of spontaneity, anxiety increases. And so he's just laying down this formula here. The more the child is in the dialogue, murmuring. Remember the murmurers in the wilderness, in Israel in the wilderness. So your child's murmuring, not feeling at home in a sinful world. Critical criticism sets up a sinful world in its own home. It's murmuring. It's critical. It's the point of destroying the father. So the more the father brings authority into the life, if this child is now in an environment where dialogue is his means of coming to know right from wrong behavior, and the father has the antithesis now, the anxiety of the child will increase. And this is where the heart is desperately wicked. You see this? It's not only deceitful above all things, because it thinks pleasure, not doing God's will, but pleasure is a purpose of life. And if pleasure then is a purpose of life, and somebody comes in and is going to remove it, you know, take the garbage out. No, I want to go play with my friends. I'm going to miss, you know, they're heading down the street. I'm not going to be able to make it. Become desperately wicked. You know, the two-year-old shaking his fist and that stare of death at the parent. With entire loss of spontaneity, anxiety reaches its maximum, the point of panic. See, this is the language. 600 social psychology books. It's all about all of it. Psychology, sociology. It's all about the destruction of the father's authority. No other purpose. Psalms 36, 1 through 4. The transgression of the wicked saith within my heart, there is no fear of God before his eyes. For he flattereth himself in his own eyes, until his iniquity be found to be hateful. The words of his mouth are iniquity and deceit. He is left off to be wise and to do good. He devises mischief upon his bed. He setteth himself in a way that is not good. He abhorreth not evil. 2 Timothy 4, chapter 4, 3 and 4. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine. But after their own lust shall they heap unto themselves teachers, having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall be turned unto fables. There's, in some of my issues, I talk about Thomas Kuhn, who worked with Ralph Tyler. Ralph Tyler, Benjamin Bloom, dedicated his first taxonomy to. Well, they all admit it doesn't work. Even Bloom, in his 40-year retrospect, says, we don't know whether this stuff really works. He was thrilled that they found the word taxonomy, and everybody thought, oh, that's science. Yeah, we know all about taxonomy, so this must be true. No, it's never been proven. It's all subjective, and they admit it. I just encourage you to get on some of my issues and look up some of Bloom's statements. We don't know if this thing is really true, but we're all going to do it. And so that's the climate change. That whole thing, it's a fable. Jeremiah 6, 16 and 17. Thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the way, and see, and ask for the old paths. Where is the good way? And walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your soul. This is all about the soul. But they said, we will not walk therein. Also I set watchmen over you, saying, hearken to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, we will not hearken. Hello, America today. 2 Thessalonians 2, 11 and 12. And for this cause, and what cause? Men have rejected God. Men have rejected the Father's authority. God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Jeremiah 17:5, God gives us a warning. Cursed be the man that trusts in man, and maketh the flesh his arm, and whose heart departeth from the Lord. Now, I've always said in meetings, don't even trust me. You take everything a person, you bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Casting down every imagination that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. Now Jeremiah continues, blessed is the man that trusteth in the Lord, and whose hope the Lord is. And then Ecclesiastes 11:9, I love this verse. I mean, it lays it out. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou, that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Now God desires that none be lost. In Isaiah 55:7, let the wicked forsake his way. This process, Bloom's taxonomy, the dialoguing of opinions to a consensus, is wicked. It is wicked. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon.